Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, a place where you're in the know. I'm Michael Krasny, KQED San Francisco's host of Forum and your moderator for today's program. You can find us at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on YouTube channel. Last summer, at the 34th annual America's Cup hometown team, Oracle USA, found themselves down 8-1 against Emirates team New Zealand. With Jimmy Spithill at the helm, Oracle managed 8 straight wins in a row to take the cup in one of the greatest comebacks in the sport's history. This victory, however, was a decade in the making. After Oracle CEO and billionaire Larry Ellison left the St. Francis Yacht Club, he found a perfect, if unlikely, partner in car mechanic Norbert Byron. Together, they took home the trophy in 2010 for the Golden Gate Yacht Club, and with 2013's victory, they are now back-to-back champions in one of the oldest competitions in international sports. Joining us to discuss their hard-won victories and the danger and drama of the catamaran, please welcome Oracle Team USA skipper Jimmy Spithill. Commodore of San Francisco's Golden Gate Yacht Club, Norbert Byron. And Julian Guthrie, San Francisco Chronicle reporter and author of the newly updated book, The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup, twice. Julian Guthrie. Welcome. Well, Skipper, let me begin with you. You just kind of come off the water, haven't you? Doing some recreation here in the San Francisco Bay, taking it easy?
Yeah, another adventure on the bay. It's one of my favorite places to go on the water is San Francisco Bay. Lately I've been into this kiteboarding, or now we do it, ironically and funny enough, on a foil, you know, so it's a foil board. So that's a big challenge. It's very, very tough. But the place to really go and do it is San Francisco Bay. It is the ultimate test if you're into water sports. So it's been great to get out. And I think also the fact that I love team sports, but in a way it's been kind of refreshing to go out and have to take it on my own without all of the big kind of entourage that goes with a huge team like Oracle Team USA. So that's been quite refreshing. And it's tough, you know, sort of pushed me. So it's been a great little exercise, and to hang out with a lot of the local guys too.
We want to talk, obviously, about the race and about the extraordinary comeback, but how do you stay in shape? I know you box. You go out and do a lot of things, essentially, to keep as fit as you are.
Yeah, well, look, I think one of the great things about San Francisco is that people are very, very active. You know, I live in the marina, and every hour of the day there's someone running, you know, along that track, and everyone's out there. And I think, you can jump in a car and be in the hills of Marin, or you can be out on the bay, which I love. So, lately it's just been a lot of different sports. We've been training a little bit in the gym. We've been paddling, you know, this stand-up paddling, surfing, windsurfing, kiteboarding. It's just everything. The thing I love about it is if you're into getting out and being active, well, you know, this is a great town for it. There's a lot of things to do and a lot of people to you can take along with you. So, yeah, a bit of everything, just really getting amongst the environment.
So, of course, I think people are eager to hear your thoughts now in retrospect about how you managed to win this race, being 8-1 down. But I was reading Julian's excellent book, and she put everything up to date. And at the third race, you actually said, "It's bad luck, fellas." Did you believe that at the third race?
In a long competition like that, it's probably the most important thing is to not think too far into the future and, you know, towards the end. You really have to take it one step at a time, and I think it's just a classic lesson in those competitions. And one thing we've you know, I've been doing a lot of talks with younger, the next generation, you know, the kids, and sort of saying to them, well, look, not all regattas or competitions or even in life or business, not everything starts off the way you would hope. Sometimes you get a bit of a rough start and, you know, next thing you know, you find yourself with a bit of a battle on your hands. But, you know, that doesn't mean it's over. And, you know, the important thing is to learn from it. And in an event like that, it really is almost like a bit of a marathon. You know, it's a multi-week event. And, you know, it's not about starting the race with the fastest boat. It's finishing the race with the fastest boat. And that, you know, it's sort of never over until it's over.
I don't want to embarrass the Commodore, but he had written a concessions piece when it was 8-1. so at that point, did you really think you could come back? When it was 8-1?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's you go home at the end of the day, and when it got to that point, you can't help but stop your mind thinking about, well, you know, what could happen here, you know, if we lose tomorrow. But really didn't spend a whole lot of time on that. It was all about, you know, I'd seen the team in some really tough situations. You know, one of them being the capsize out there on our first boat, and then a couple of other what I call curveballs that came our way. And that, I think, is the test of any champion or champion team. It's not so much the winning, it's what you do when the times are tough. You know, how are you going to react as a team when, you know, you're sort of, you're in the trench and you've got to jump back out again? Who do you want next year? And that, we've been fortunate enough to see that, you know, to really see the team under the super high-pressure situation. So, you know, I knew in my mind we had the team to do it, we had the people, and slowly as each day was going along, we were learning a lot together, and we were improving the boat, and we were getting faster. And so, you know, it wasn't a done deal, because you'd never know in racing, and especially on these boats on that bay. But the key thing was we were learning, and we were, you know, really taking bigger steps than the other guys at that point.
Well, Julian captures in her book how the team changed and how the tactics changed and how upwind was conquered and vanquished and all of those kinds of things. But what do you attribute largely to? I mean, I know you had a great team, and that would be clearly, as a skipper, one of the things that you would cite right away, but to really coming back and coming back in that extraordinary way that you did.
Yeah, I really do put it down to the team in that it just seemed to be a group of people that, when the pressure really came on, they really seemed to excel or almost seemed to relax, you know, as the pressure came on. And, you know, not in a reckless sort of a way, but you really sort of looked out for your teammates. And that, I think, is what gave you confidence in yourself, was looking at your teammates, how they were acting, how there just wasn't the, you know, it wasn't like there was panic in there. It was almost the opposite, like, you know, no problem. You know, we'll come out tomorrow and we'll just do one at a time. And so that, I think, really fueled everyone up and brought the team together and made us incredibly strong. I think the other thing that the team that helped them was how the city and really the nation started to react and get behind the group. And I think at the start, people weren't really sure what they were going to get with the America's Cup in the city. But then when we started to come back and people started to see this product, you know, that blew them away on TV and also if you got to see it live, then they started getting behind it and, you know, really took the team on as their own. And that sort of energy that we felt every day we went down to the dockout show, I mean, the messages that we were getting from throughout the nation and internationally, that made a huge difference. And you could see the guys just naturally lift each day we would leave the dockout show, as an example. So it was a whole lot of things in one, but I've really got to put it down to the team, just really, you know, refusing to go away.
So, Commodore, you want to say something reflecting back on why you were writing that concession speech?
Well, I think I'm a military man. You have to be ready for the retreat. But I wrote the words down so I wouldn't fumble them when I gave it over to the New Zealand Commodore, basically. But it never happened.
I mean, this has been quite an extraordinary journey for you, too. I mean, I think you described it as kind of rags to riches, and it's still ongoing. It's still as exciting in terms of what's coming up?
Every day. Every day. From day one when we started this endeavor with Larry back in 2001 up till now, it's very intriguing, the America's Cup. There's a lot of espionage involved. There's a lot of splendor behind the scenes, and there's a lot of what if what's going to happen, and there's no real answer till it's done. So it's a job. It's a big
and
job.
Thinking about the next cup, just looking ahead for a moment, reading some discussions about maybe Larry Ellison thinking different cities and more competition from different cities. Is that where things are maybe headed?
Well, I think we have to be open.
I mean, it may be premature, but what are your thoughts?
No, I think it's a good question, and I think a lot of people are here tonight to see if I can tell them something, which I'm not going to. But, you know, number one, we just had the most fabulous race in the 162-year history of the America's Cup. I mean, that was, had to be hard run. Number two, it happened right outside here in San Francisco, so I can't think of any other place that would be better than that. But with that said in mind, the Golden Gate Yacht Club, their duty as a trustee of the Cup is to make sure that there's going to be fair and impartial racing for all the challengers involved. So we have to make sure it's all good for everybody. And the city is working with us right now. We are working with the city as well. As you do know, other locations have opened up to us. But hands down, for myself and my personally, and I'll say that in front of everybody, I want it to be San Francisco, but we have yet to see still. Okay. And if I can add to everybody, write your supervisor, write the mayor, tell them that you want to have it here. Always good to put a little pressure on them.
Are the boats going to be different?
Right now, the protocol isn't finished, but we're looking at a 60 to 62 footer out there. Mm-hmm. Catamarans.
Yeah. So inquiring minds want to know, Julian Guthrie. Somebody said to me, Julian Guthrie, great reporter, but not a mechanic and not an a skipper or a commodore, any of these kinds of things, and yet she wrote this extraordinary book where she gets into all the technical details and everything. Talk about the genesis of this, how you got into this whole thing.
Well, I wasn't drawn in by the sailing. I wasn't drawn in by the radiator repair industry, although I was kind of—I have to say—I was pretty—I was pretty—I was pretty captivated by that. What drew me in was this unlikely alliance between the billionaire and the mechanic, and then I mean, I just thought, I love this story. I want to find out why, first of all, Larry Ellison is, you know, pursuing the America's Cup. What is the America's Cup? Why is he going after it with all that he already has? What is it about this historic regatta that has drawn him and so many, you know, people who have these huge, huge dreams into this old regatta? And then this, again, this unlikely alliance, this unlikely partnership with the Commodore, and that drew me in first. And then it was this really cool history of the regatta. And then it was getting into the sailors, the builders, the engineers, all of the people who have made this their lives. And so it was really a human story for me. It was really the human drama of it that captivated me from the beginning and remains so. I mean, when I met with Jimmy a week after, or maybe it was days after the victory, September 26th, you know, I wanted to know, how do you come back when you are down 8-1? You know, how do you find the courage in yourself, you know, to come back every single day? And I was intrigued by, again, by the human drama, the human spirit. And that's what I saw this story as being about. Yes, great technological innovation. What were the differences in how they sailed? You know, what did they have the camber of the wing at 40 versus 30? I was interested in all of that. But just as a human story, you know, what do you do when you're down? How do you fight back? So that's what, again, drew me in from the beginning, the human story, and then it's kept me totally intrigued.
That's an inspiring and dramatic story, no doubt about it. And what you do, though, in terms of your own mastery of the material is really quite impressive. I mean, you learn all the technical stuff. And there's actually, I mean, some of it's very exciting because you bring us back there and you make it vivid in your prose. But you're also, there's one at one moment when you're at the tiller, and you make that vivid as well. I mean,
Jimmy.
You're all excitement.
Well, you know, people ask me if I'm a sailor, and I say, well, I was out sailing with, you know, with Jimmy Spithill. And so that's all I kind of need to say.
She's a sailor. She, we're also training against Russell Kurtz, who's a bit of a sailor himself.
Yes.
And in that test, she actually beat Russell, so I think she's quite a sailor.
Thank you.
Where do you see it going next? I mean, in terms of just your own reportage, likelihood of it coming back to San Francisco, you think?
You know, I don't know, but what I loved was how accessible this regatta was, how it brought the race, you know, to close to shore for the first time in the history of the Cup. The app itself was downloaded hundreds of thousands of times. You have, you know, people like Jimmy Spithill who becomes a hero.
Are there any people
hero.
Really like Jimmy Spithill, by the way?
No.
I think he's sui generis.
He is, exactly. But who becomes this great role model. I mean, my son was talking about he wants to, when he's 18 or 20, when he wants to be a part of the America's Cup. You had kids at Halloween in San Francisco dressing up as Team USA. You know, it really caught the attention of people outside of sailing, which was a step in the direction that Larry Ellison sought. So whether it comes back to San Francisco or not, I don't know, but I think people here are hooked, you know, people who are totally new to the race. So that was exciting to see. And I'm going to be following it always because, again, I love the technological innovation. I love the sailing drama. I love the human stories. I want to know, you know, what Jimmy does in the next, you know, in the next race, what kind of boats they're going to use, who the teams are going to be. I have never in my life experienced such drama as I did, you know, as a quasi-outsider, quasi-insider. And I told people who've been involved in this Cup for years, I don't know how you do it because there were so many ups and downs. You know, there were so many depressing things going into it. And then you see Team USA losing and losing. And then you see this turnaround start. And it was just like nothing I've ever seen before. The adrenaline around it and the excitement around it and the drama around it. It was rather unnerving. I mean, even as a spectator. But Jimmy kept his cool so well. And one thing he did which was really interesting was, you know, they trained with former Navy SEALs. And to live, you know, to work in the moment. And he was talking about one race at a time. You know, but they weren't thinking about all they had to do, you know, when they were down 8-1. They were thinking about, we need to go out here and we need to win this race today. Isn't that right?
Mm. Yeah. I could see, though, you know, in fact, I kept thinking when you were down 8-1 and started to come back, you must have thought about those 2 points a lot. I mean, it could be demoralizing to think that you lost those 2 points because of, well, violation of the rules and all that, yeah?
Not much, to be honest. I'm serious. It's, you know, there's so many things. I mean, life isn't always fair. That's just a fact, you know? And so you've really got to play the cards you get dealt. And you can spend energy wishing you'd been dealt a much better hand. But at the end of the day, it's not going to happen. You know, the cards that come your way, you've got to play them. And that's where you want to focus your energy, and that's where you want to focus your time. And, you know, in this game, it really is about time and how you spend it, especially as a group. So we, you know, in that particular circumstance, once it was done, you know, and it was okay, on we go, we're moving on. Because it really, we could not change, you know, that situation. What we could do was affect the outcome on the water. And that really was our motivating factor was, well, we can win this on the water. You know, it doesn't matter what happens on the shore, we can go out there and win races, and that's really what we tried to put everything into.
Can you give us a preview of what's ahead? I want to go to the questions from the audience, but what you foresee ahead, particularly in the type of... We got a little bit from the comment or more from you.
Yeah, well, look, I think one of Larry's big visions is we've got to bring the costs down for sure. I mean, as exciting and, you know, I mean, the America's Cup was like you couldn't have dreamt the way it went and how it finished. But obviously it would have been great to see more teams in the Challenger Series. So that already we know there are going to be some fantastic teams from Challengers. So... costs. Okay, so the boat's going to be a bit smaller. Looking at like a 62-footer. So production costs come down. It'll probably be crewed by, you know, around 8 guys, so a few less sailors. Try and bring that team size down. And there's a lot of lessons, you know. I mean, what was just done this last America's Cup was, I mean, in so many different areas, not just the sailing, the engineering, the boat building, but it was kind of like going to the moon because it had never been done before and you were kind of learning, you know, on the way. So there's a lot of great things. There's a lot of things that can be done better. And that's what's really exciting looking forward. The boats will be just as fast, if not faster. The reason for that is that the engineering, you know, the technology and the foils, you know, there's so much left there to be learned. So it's an exciting time for the event. As Julian alluded to, I mean, the audience has built up. You know, non-sailors really got into it and could understand it and were educated, not only by the TV, but I think by the work that Julian's done and people get engaged into it. So, yeah, it's a cool time to be involved.
Just out of my own curiosity, once the race was done, once it was won, once you had this great victory and everything, there is a kind of sportsmanship often. What happened with Dean Barker? I mean, did you two have any kind of confab after, congratulate each other? How did that turn out?
Yeah, we both teams afterwards, obviously, you know, we took the boats back to the, you know, the respective bases. And then before the presentation, both teams were kind of brought in by chase boats to that pier, you know, the America's Cup pier. And then we were able to sort of shake hands and have a bit of a chat. And, you know, it was, it's a funny thing because I think me especially, I'm like this where, you know, I literally become kind of obsessed with the person you're going up against. And, you know, and that you just literally, it doesn't come across where we literally want to kill them, you know? I mean, it's that sort of, in a competitive sporting standpoint. So, but then funny enough, once you cross the finish line, there was one of the first things I was thinking about. I thought, wow, you know, because I know what the New Zealand press is like. And, you know, he was really carrying the weight of a country, you know, on his shoulders. So yeah, I spoke to Dean on the dock and I just said, you know, thanks very much for the battle and, you know, you'll be back. You know, you'll come back from this. And, you know, there's not a lot I think you can really say in a situation like that. But it was, you know, it was good to sort of, you know, shake the person's hand you've just been going head to head in the battle of your life with and, you know, share a few words. So, but yeah, I mean, look, since then, it's obviously we've been quite in separate countries and, you know, they're obviously looking at trying to get a team back together again, so I haven't had a whole lot of interaction since that point, to be honest.
And just before we go to the questions from the audience, I just have to ask Julian, I learned from your book a couple of things that probably a lot of people don't know, and that is Jimmy had the flu on that final race. And also, can you talk about I'm thinking flu and glue. There's a whole story about glue that really is
that's a natural
pretty
segue.
Amazing,
yes,
too.
Yes, flu and glue. So there's amazing things that were going on behind the scenes. You know, there were incremental changes to make these, you know, these victories happen, and there were these aha moments that they had. And then there were these, you know, near catastrophes that were playing out on the water that people were also not aware of. And one was the final race. So there it is, Wednesday, September 26th, 25th, thank you. And, you know, the race of their lives. And, you know, Larry Ellison was telling me the story. I met with him 1 week after the victory, and he was exhausted. But he was telling me that he was on his boat, and they were all watching, and they saw this, you know, one of the crew guys going, or the repair guys going up to patch a flap in the wing. And Larry is using, you know, more colorful language than I could possibly use here, and screaming, you know, because this was the moment. And there's no way they cannot race, but they have to fix this thing. He said, what the, you know, is going on? And someone said, oh, they're gluing it. They're fixing it by glue. Jimmy, do you know about I mean, obviously you knew about it, but
and duct tape.
No duct tape. But he's like, glue, are you kidding me? And someone said, very expensive glue. But anyway, so the whole race, they're watching thinking, is this going to hold? Is this going to hold? What were you thinking?
Yeah, there's so many stories like that. You know, that people didn't hear where the, you know, a shore crew, or it's a lot like a pit crew on a race car team, really saved us, you know, because we had played this card, this post, you get one, what we call the get-out-of-jail-free card, where if you had a, you know, failure or equipment problem, you could basically say, okay, we're not going to race the next race. And we played that very early on because it was obvious we had a big speed problem, and we had to get back and try and spend some time together and solve this issue. So that put a lot of pressure on the Shore guys. We couldn't not race. We had to. We were on every time. So sure enough, we leave the dockout show. You get about 45 minutes to warm up before the start, and bang, you know, the wing breaks. So we send Jeff, the guy up there, up the wing, and that in itself is a bit of a it's 70 feet in the air, and it's there's nothing to hold on to. It's a wing. You know, you don't see many people sitting out in the wing while you're flying along. So it he's up there, and you could tell it was serious, you know. So the guys, the rest of the Shore guys jumped on. They sent up the expensive glue, and they just started injecting it everywhere. And at the same time, Ben Ainslie and I were trying to sort of keep ourselves busy, you know, because Team New Zealand are just going round and round the racetrack, warming up for the start, and we're just sitting there. And Ben had a almost like an iPad screen, you know, and it had the current models, what was going on. So we're talking about the racetrack, okay. And next thing you know, this grinding noise, you know, they started grinding carbon on the back because they were sending carbon plates up to Jeff to try and glue in place. And it's a terrible sound whenever someone cuts carbon. So they start cutting carbon, and it's just like a screeching noise. And Ben and I just look at each other and just started laughing, you know. And we're just like, this can't go down like this, you know. But, you know, again, you know, these guys pulled it off. Yeah. You know, they pulled off a repair that they shouldn't really have been able to. And he got off with about 5 minutes to go before the start, and, you know, off we went. So, and as Julian said, I mean, you just really didn't know, you know, well, how long is it going to hold together? You know, and before Jeff got off the boat, he said, "Oh, mate, if you just take it easy for the first, you know, first few minutes." And,
so, just take it easy.
Yeah. It's sort of like jumping in an F-18 and saying, just take it easy, you know.
Some of the amateur sailors here may want the name of that expensive glue just before.
Yeah. Can we get in one more quick story?
Of course.
Okay, so, Jimmy, you've got to say, a lot of people saw the final race and saw you finally flash a smile. Here's the guy who went to the press conferences and had this great bravado, and, you know, we're going to be back here, you know, tomorrow, and you just had this great art of war going. And then, though, you get to that final race, and you crack a smile right within, you know, within reach almost of the finish line. A lot of people think that it was because, victory is here, and it wasn't. Can you tell about that?
Yeah, there's
such a great moment.
We were sort of on the final run, just about to make the turn there, Alcatraz, and then, you know, head towards the finish. And we're sort of on the edge, as you are in these boats, and we're sending it down there and getting towards the boundary near Alcatraz, and right before there, Kyle was trimming the wing, and, you know, this is a 130-foot, you know, massive wing sail, you know, and he's got the whole thing in his hands. We hit some chop and got some gas in it, and he just lost the sheet. And so he lost it, and then with his other hand just reached over and just grabbed it in time, you know, fingertip stuff. And if he hadn't, you know, it would have been a big, you know what would have happened. So So he just grabbed it, and I just sort of looked at him and laughed, and I just sort of, I patted him on the back, and I said, you know, nice catch, mate. And and he sort of looked up, and he sort of smiled, and it just sort of, I think, relieved the tension. You know, I mean, here's a guy that, you know, by the way, Kyle Langford, the youngest guy on the team, he got thrown into the race team, I think it was 3 days before the first race of the America's Cup. And, it was incredible to see someone really grow and take it on. And it was one of those moments where you just had to smile and defuse it. And I said, mate, hang on to that thing. We're almost there.
Well, it's time now for our audience question period. We have a number of questions, but I also want to say this is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking to America's Cup winner, Oracle Team USA skipper, Jimmy Spithill, Commodore of San Francisco's Golden Gate Yacht Club, Norbert Byron, and Julian Guthrie, author of the newly updated book, The Billionaire and the Mechanic, How Larry Ellison and a Car Mechanic Teamed Up to Win, Sailing's Greatest Race, the America's Cup, twice. I'm Michael Krasny, your moderator, and you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with them on Facebook and Twitter, and the club's YouTube channel. So first question for you, Commodore. You had said before that, you know, if people want to bring it back here, they should contact the supervisors and the mayor and all that. But the question that came to me probably faded right off the top here, probably a question on a lot of people's minds, what needs to be done to bring America's Cup back to SFO. Are there any other suggestions that you have in addition to what you said before?
Well, I think right now we have to wait for what the protocol is going to be coming out. It's going to be fairly soon. But again, I would stress, talk to your supervisor, send them a letter, tell them that you're interested in there. In the America's Cup here, it was the best race we ever had. Bring it back to San Francisco. We can do it again in 2017.
Here's a question that says, wonderful achievement. However, in the Olympics races are won and lost by fractions of a second. So are these boats where races are decided so dramatically a good choice for the America's Cup going forward? Commodore, go to you on this.
I think what we saw in the last race, in fact, September 25th at 1:15, I think everybody's eyes in San Francisco were glued on the water, no matter where you were at. It was based on those boats. So, excellent boats. There was, besides a little bit of glue used, there wasn't no major breakdowns. There was almost a capsize, but they held up pretty good. And I think it was an excellent race. Those boats are really good. It's the future.
Skipper Spithill, key regrets. What would you have done differently?
There's so many things in hindsight. You know, I mean, it's a tough thing to spend too much time on. You know, like you think a lot about the hard moments and the losses when you're an athlete, because that's usually the best, you know, chance of learning, and, you know, defeats really education. But, you know, I think it's a tough one. I don't know how to answer it, to be honest, because, of course, there's so many things I would have done a lot different over the, you know, that sort of a four-year campaign, and I think as a team decision-wise. But you're sort of doing the best you can at the time, and you are, you know, as a group, you're trying to make those decisions, and it's all about trying to get out there and win the races. So would I have done stuff different? No question. But hopefully I'm going to learn from that and apply that into the future. But I don't know if I'd go into detail as to specifically what I would have done back, you know, a year or so ago.
Well, let's look to the future a minute, which this next question brings up. What changes in protocols for boat sales and events do you envision?
Well, look, I think the concept's really, really cool in that the boats, you're seeing athletes on the boats. I mean, these guys are like linebackers. They're like pushed. I mean, the cardio, they're at 100% heart rates. I mean, the serious risk for the guys out there. You know, a lot like auto racing. It's like a turning point. It's funny, you know, because I was in Malaysia last week and I was speaking to a few of the Formula One car drivers, and they were saying, yeah, you guys are going through a similar period we went through quite a long time ago. You know, we're starting to figure out, hey, this is, you know, it's an exciting time. You got the technology, but, you know, from a safety point of view, you're learning a lot. You know, that's never really happened in sailing, you know. So I think that's really healthy for the sport. But the boats, I think the style of racing, the race lengths, the times, I think the camera angles and the graphics, that educational experience was fantastic. So, yeah, I see it really, you know, really stepping forwards. I think more teams, but I can tell you right now there are some great teams out there that will be in the Challenger Series. And the racing will be even stronger than you saw last time.
I'll just keep going through the questions. Please tell us what you and Russell said in that one-on-one discussion in the support boat.
He was just asking me to help him out with his golf swing, you know, because he he just couldn't figure out why I can continually hit it further than him. But, look, I mean, we were just discussing, you know, the postponement card. We were discussing, you know, a few things on the water. But that's another example. I mean, I think a lot of the learning that came for the guys that were on the boat, it came from the people, the team members that weren't racing, you know, in that we had great coaches. We had, you know, we had obviously backup sailors because we had to race our own two boats against each other. Russell Coutts, you know, some fantastic designers, engineers, you know, so people watching from the outside. And it's hard to get that view from the outside when you're on the boat. You know, so we heavily relied on those guys. We heavily relied on watching what the Kiwis were doing, you know, and really post-processing that. So that was just another opportunity to really get together quickly while it was still fresh and, you know, to try and capture the lessons.
Question for the Commodore. What can you do to get more defenders to participate in the next America's Cup?
To get more defenders?
Competitors.
Or competitors. Well, number one, we're looking at the protocol right now and with Hamilton Island Yacht Club, our challenger of record. The World Series, as you remember, the 45 Series, we had them throughout the world. We're planning on doing this again. We're thinking about an Eastern and a Western, or basically an Atlantic and a Pacific. which will help cut the cost down and get the teams involved. And one thing even before that, remember on the last America's Cup when we had the first sign-ups in November of 2010, I think we had up to 15 teams sign up at that time and make it a challenge against the Golden Gate Yacht Club. Unfortunately, economics, the economy was down, sponsors weren't giving money out to the teams, and of course, a lot of teams dropped out. I think the vision that Larry and Russell have right now, along with the Golden Gate Yacht Club, is basically keep the 45s on a world thing, on a world regatta. It keeps the cost down. Every team has a chance to get in there. In the elimination series, there's a little talk going back and forth. The elimination series will be on the 45s, and whoever wins those, two teams on each side of the United States, the Atlantic and the Pacific, they will then have the chance to get into what the challenge series will be on the 62s, whether it be Louis Vuitton or whoever is going to be sponsoring that event. And from there on, we go to the America's Cup. And again, that's about costs. And we're looking forward to that.
Question for you, Julian. Why did Oracle get better, but Team New Zealand did not?
Oh, boy. Well, that's what I, went back and wrote an additional 100 and some pages about. It's, they were behind. Team New Zealand came very well prepared. They came to win the cup and bring it back home. And Team USA had been diverted to other things. They had problems. They had the near calamitous capsize a year before, set them back months. There were a lot of reasons why they came in not as prepared as they should have been. But then it's amazing to think about, and again, this is what is so compelling about this whole story. And this, what Jimmy and the whole team, and by team, the engineers and the designers and the builders and the support crew, everybody pulled off. And that is, they're looking at everything. The boat comes in off the water, and the builders are looking at why is the paint coming off the rudders? They're making a study of this. They're going to school, on Team New Zealand, looking at the aerial photography that was taken. They're looking at the shape of Team New Zealand's wing versus their own. They're looking at the sailing angles that they were sailing versus the way Team New Zealand was sailing. They're trying to come up with this riddle of why they're slower upwind. So they were having to solve all of these problems really by studying what they were doing, but really looking again at what Team New Zealand was doing and working around the clock. They had, as soon as the boat came in, they had guys there all night working in shifts. And it was, it was a huge, impressive, relentless team effort. Again, incremental things and then a few aha moments, which were very cool to learn about.
This name has come up before when I had you on the radio program, but it says specifically about the book. Why was Marcus Young never mentioned in the book, since he was the Commodore of the club during 2004-2008?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think he was involved actually. What was he there when you took over?
No, he became a member in 2004.
Okay. Winning two races, what was your most memorable moment of America's Cup 34, and where will the 35th be at next? Now, we've kind of touched on that. We don't know, really. But is there a most more memorable moment for any of you, for all of you? Jimmy?
Oh, I think it would have to be right after crossing the line, on the final race, because it was such a... it was a deep hole, I can tell you. It was a...
That's one definitely to cherish.
Yeah, and I think the real thing was, as soon as we'd crossed, I'd obviously seen the guys' faces on board. They had nothing left in the tank. They had to take themselves to a place that you can't sort of train for that. You just have to hope you've got the right guys that, when it gets to that point, they're just going to find something else and deliver. And that's what they had to do. Julian alluded, I had the flu for the last few days. I wasn't the only one. There was a few other guys on board the boat, but, they refused to let that stop them. So seeing their faces, and then real quickly after, obviously seeing Larry, the designers, the engineers, the shore team, their faces, and then getting back to the, when we finally got the boat back to the dock, to our base, that was awesome. It was just, everyone was down there. Everyone got onto the boat, and Yeah, it was just like we're all on this trampoline. It was like a kid's trampoline party. It was an amazing experience. Just the pure, ecstasy, euphoria, everything mixed up into one.
This may amuse you. I'll try to give it the right tone. We all loved having you and the AC in San Francisco, with all the advantages of San Francisco: wind, access for fans, great TV backdrop, great public support, et cetera, et cetera. How could you even consider leaving?
You asking me, or?
I think it's to you.
Well, I think the people of San Francisco are great, but as you know, the people don't always make the decisions, for the city and what they decide to go forwards with. San Francisco was fantastic. I mean, I love the city. I love the place. I've met a lot of great people, locals, outside of the America's Cup world. And I'm still living here. I've got two kids in school here, and it's a great place. But, it's, that's life. Who knows what will happen? There's obviously a few steps that need to be taken. It is one of the greatest racetracks in the world. No question about it. I mean, you hear me talk about it all the time. I mean, I love that bay. I love getting out there. It's so demanding if you're into a water sport or as an athlete. Every single day, especially on a boat like that, every single day you'd go out there and there'd be two or three times where you'd avert disaster, So you'd be constantly pushed. And it was a physical battle, but a real mental challenge going out there. And, you always want to learn, I think, and get better, and that's a place where you can, it constantly teaches you.
Getting a lot of questions as to whether you have a preference. You want to go on record on that?
I just want great racing. I mean, honestly, I think there's a lot of great places, and that's what's great about our sport, is there's a lot of great harbours, places where you can hold it. But, man, I mean, what we did out there on that bay, I mean, it's something. Obviously, I'm never going to forget for the rest of my life. And it's no matter what happens going forwards with the America's Cup, where it ends up, I mean, it holds a real special place, for me, this city. I mean, you go through something like that, and it's hard to put into words.
Here's a question, a little tricky maybe. What's your opinion of sailors coming from their own country?
What do you guys think? I mean, it's a really interesting debate, and it gets debated a lot. My take on it is I always think it shouldn't be where you just happen to be born, or it shouldn't be the colour of your passport. It should be the talent, that person. That it doesn't matter if he grows up in the slums or the ghetto or, a lower socioeconomic place, but he's got the drive, and he's got the fight, and he will work his butt off to get there. And I think, to me, that's what I love about sport, because there is politics in life. There is things happen in life that, aren't always fair, but the greatest thing about sport is that when that starting gun fires or that the bell rings, nothing else matters except you and that individual or the two teams that are going head-to-head in the battle. So I've always, promoted that it should come down to talent or the people that really want it. But I see the other side too, And I mean, look, I have a natural love affair for America because Australia's always had a very close connection. There's a lot of history there of, supporting each other and really like our brothers. My family's American, My two boys are American and my wife. So I obviously have a natural connection there. But I think there needs to be something in there, whether it be a percentage rule that can help seed sailors up. But if you ask me, I think it should be it needs to go to the guys that want it and are willing to put the work in and the sacrifice, because that's what it's like in real life.
You have a take on that, Commodore?
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, I came over on the boat too.
Yeah.
And I'm a Commodore of an American Yacht Club now, right? That happens to be the defender of the America's Cup, so I look at it that way. But Jimmy's right. I mean, you have to have the talent on there. You have to have the person who wants to be on there. Any Trekkie fans out here? Star Trek? Come on, there's got a couple. There we go. See, all right. We have Uhuru. We had Spock. We had the Irish guy down below. You had an international crew. You had Chekhov out there. But it was called the USS Enterprise, right? Okay. Well, we're racing for Oracle Team USA. Scotty, that was it. The Olympics. I mean, you have, you know, nationalized teams on there. Although Jamaican bobsled team, I don't know about that one, but that is an all nation crew on there. I could see that. But in this, you know, I do like a partial nationality on there. I think we should have a few more Americans on board. I'd like to see that. But it is still a U.S. team. It is still a U.S. yacht club. And we sailed for San Francisco this time. We defended it successfully, and I'm pretty happy about that.
Well, a lot of questions for you, Jimmy. How important to the win was the tactician's change to Ben, at least.
So we made a personnel, a tactician change, you know, that rarely ever works in, or has worked, I guess, in past history in our game. But I think it was a combination in that, you know, John Kostecki was a very, very important team member. You know, one of the best sailors out there. I mean, he's one of, I think, the only guys that have won a Volvo race, Olympic medal, America's Cup. You know, we'd won the previous America's Cup together. We dominated this sort of AC World Series. But, you know, it just it wasn't working. And one thing that we were very good at inside the team was being incredibly candid and honest with each other. I guess the other thing is that, well, you know, when you're a tactician, you want a fast boat. And it was pretty obvious when we started that competition that we had a slow boat. And that in itself leads you to take decisions you may not take. You know, you may take more risk because you know, certainly on the upwind leg. But it, you know, we had to make the call, and we sat down with JK, and he really just straight off the bat, he said, look, I think you should make the change. You know, I think we need to change something. You know, we've got to, you know, mix, try something. And I think that was a really good thing for the team to see, that here's someone that if there's one guy on the team that has a lot riding on the America's Cup or being on the race boat, well, it was John. I mean, he's a hometown hero, really. He grew up in San Francisco. You know, so for him to put the team before himself was a huge thing to do. And it's easy to say that, but when you're in that sort of a moment to do that, I thought was, you know, really showed just the kind of guy JK was. And now everyone saw that, obviously, in the team. And so that, you know, was another great example of putting the team first and yourself second, that we want to get the result. But also Ben did an incredible job. I mean, I think the fact also that he came in without the baggage of the extra start of the race series, the fact that we were improving the boat. You know, this is a personality game as well. I mean, he and Tom Slingsby in the back of the boat seemed to gel much better. You know, they just openly communicated more. So, you know, it was really all of the above. But at the end of the day, you know, whether it was Ben, John, or whatever was going on, it was always about, well, what's best for the team, you know. And, you know, John's example is the perfect one because he, you know, put himself second and you know, the team benefited from it.
Julian, a question from the audience. Since you were the quasi-insider and the quasi-outsider and you were there reporting all along, wants to know, did Larry Ellison give talks to the team during games? Maybe you can talk in a more broad way about Larry's role in all this.
He gave a talk right before the start where he went to the base and gave a talk. But he was, you know, he was living it. He was there, you know, every race. He was strategizing after every race. You know, he's a very accomplished sailor himself, which some people don't know. They think he maybe was just this parachute, you know, owner who would parachute in at the end and grab a trophy. But he's a very accomplished sailor himself.
And so, a pilot, which is important, too, I think, in understanding.
Well, in understanding, yeah, these wing sails. It became
role.
Important. Jimmy actually went in later on and took flying lessons to learn how to sail again. But so Larry was, you know, he was watching every single race. He was debriefing with Russell Coutts after each race. He was coming up with his own ideas. He was strategizing. He was losing sleep. He was as angst-ridden as it gets. And there's a funny vignette in the book about how, you know, on his chase boat, it started out with, you know, his family and friends. And as the losses continued, and I can imagine as his temper started to take over. You know, he's a big presence.
There were fewer
and fewer people who ended up on that boat. And the last man standing is a good friend of his, almost a family member, who happens to be an FBI agent who's used to dealing with very dangerous individuals. This is a true story. It's true.
And I was just remembering one point you described him as apoplectic.
Larry.
Moment? Yeah.
Oh, yes. I mean, there were many moments like that where, you know, there was race five where he was, you know, before the tactician change, where he went completely apoplectic. And then throughout, there were these moments, but no one would dare to get onto that chase boat with him. But he was instrumental. You know, he's obviously a brilliant guy. He knows sailing. He knows technology better than, you know, most people in the world. And this is this confluence of sailing, of technology, of persevering. And he was involved in it every step of the way. And I think he was pretty instrumental.
Skipper, another question for you. What specific sailing tactics or breaks helped you come back after 8-1? Example, decisions to sail in one direction when Emirates went the another?
Well, look, it's, you know, the tactics in these boats happen so quick. I mean, in the old boats, it was kind of like slow motion. You know, you could talk about it, you could make mistakes, and you never really got punished for it. But you could be constantly just talking, you know, in a relaxed sort of format. And in these boats, it was just one thing after the other, and it was trying to be at least one step ahead, trying to anticipate what's coming at you. You know, I mean, you're doing sort of 40, almost 50 knots a lot of the time, and you're just trying, and you hit these boundaries, and it feels like you're in a cage on a boat like that. And so you're trying, you know, the guy's physically trying to get the boat there, you're trying to just keep the thing upright, and then between Ben and Tom and myself, we're trying to communicate as to, you know, what he's thinking and what the next step will be. And if you don't stay a step ahead, if you start to fall behind in that decision-making process, then it's like an avalanche, and it's so difficult to get back ahead of it, and that's usually when it goes wrong. So, yeah, I mean, the tactics on these boats are some of the hardest decisions I think we've ever had to take, because it has to happen so quickly, and it's under such high pressure, and there's real consequence, you know, in some of them if you get them wrong.
Norbert, maybe you can speculate on this. Somebody asked, do you foresee weekend sailors with the kind of wings used on AC-72?
In the future, probably, yeah. It's an up-and-coming thing. In fact, who was that? My vice commander's here. We had somebody come in the other day with a little FJ with a hard wing on there. Yeah, exactly. It's coming out.
There's your answer. What percentage would you assign to tweaking the boat, reasons changing your strategy when accounting for your incredible comeback?
I think the biggest factor, you know, looking back in the whole thing, and there were so many of them, so it's maybe I'm not right in saying this, but I think the technique, the way we were starting to learn to sail this boat, I mean, it really takes two of the best teams in the world. If you really want to learn something, you've got to go against the very best, and you've got to be pushed by the best, and that's exactly what was happening. I mean, the level we saw there was, I don't think either team knew we could go to where we ended up. And you know, I think that's just a big part of it. I think, you know, the Kiwis were the best. I mean, they started out stronger than us. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But the fact that that pushes you, it, you know, that really brought the best out in us.
Julian, I'm going to go to you with this because I remember we talked about how when this was conceived, it was made for television in many ways. And there was a lot of emphasis on getting it on television. And one of people in the audience named Maureen says, what do you think about the 5 Emmy Award nominations for America's Cup? Thoughts on this all making sailing more exposed and more accessible to others? That was really what it was all about, and it's kind of a triumph too, isn't it?
Oh, it is, absolutely. You know, the technology that was developed by Stan Honey for this, which has been nominated for the Emmys, was just fantastic. You know, it made it accessible. So you can understand what's going on, you know, when they're going to a ley line. You can see what the boundaries are. You can see what the start box is like. And it clearly delineated this nautical playing field in a way that had never been done before. It was the most advanced superimposed graphics for television that had ever been created. And they're going to keep using that. And that, I think, played a big role in, again, making it understandable to people. It was very cool to see. And then at the end, the superimposed American flag right at the finish line. Yeah.
That was really cool. For Jimmy Spittle, can you tell us a little about the discussion in the cabin of the cruiser after your last loss?
I'm not sure what they mean in that one, to be honest.
In the cabin after your last loss, they want to know about the discussion you had.
The last loss?
When it got 8-1.
Oh, okay, yeah. When it got to 8-1. You know, at that point, we knew we had made the boat faster. We knew we were faster. We knew we could win races, but it's still a head-to-head battle. You know, there's no guarantees in a race like that where it's so close. And so, you know, it was just trying to minimize the mistakes, you know, trying to make better decisions and come together right. We knew it wasn't, you know, it was far from a done deal at that point. But, yeah, it was just every single night, every single morning. I mean, our coaches, the people around us, the designers, engineers, you know, guys like Russell, you know, Larry, it was trying to take all of that in. And it, you know, even at night, you know, I know myself and a lot of the guys on the boat who are out there all day, and you go through this post-processing moment, even which we'd be up all night watching YouTube, you know, and trying to figure out ways to be better and get faster. And so I think it was just that, you know, Julian used a good word, and it was relentless. And that's what it was. It was just this relentless attitude that we weren't going to go away. And you know, just we were going to look under every single stone if we had to. So I think that's what was happening. And but it was, you know, it was tiring too, because I think the funny thing was is when after we did win, everyone that was on the boat and a lot of the guys obviously off the boat, everyone was completely sick, you know, for about 2 weeks, because they finally, you know, the body just said, okay, that's it, I've got you.
Yeah. It's good. A little offbeat question here. How is match racing like boxing?
Well, it's head-to-head. it's head-to-head. It's kind of funny, because if you make mistakes on this boat, you're going to know about it. You make mistakes in boxing, you usually know about it pretty quickly as well. But no, I think just the reflexes and the conditioning and the training that you now need for the guys on board the boats, it really is like nothing we've ever seen. And it has taken a lot of people out of the game that just aren't at that level. It really takes the best of the best. The other thing it's done is it's lowered the age limit, no question. I mean, it's like a lot of other sports now where that, you know, we're looking for the younger guys. And I think this is another great thing that happened, you know, and that Larry and Russell steered, was this Youth America's Cup. I mean, here we are. We have a sporting the oldest sporting trophy in the world, and there is no pathway. There's no, you know, next step for the next generation. You know, how do they get in the America's Cup? I mean, if you want to have a crack at being on the San Francisco Giants, well, you play Little League as a kid. There's no guarantees, but at least you know, okay, this is my way, and here's how I've got a shot at getting there. Well, that was never really there in the America's Cup. And so, you know, they created the Youth America's Cup. Now, obviously, where are teams looking now? Well, we're looking at the Youth America's Cup. I mean, man, when you see the talent that's out there, I'll put it this way. The team that won the Youth America's Cup was a Kiwi team. Well, he's been signed on to Team New Zealand, you know, as one of the helmsmen. It's the natural place. So I think that's so healthy for the sport. And already, having done a few talks at yacht clubs and around the different sailing centres, there's a real growth in the sport, because non-sailors, non-sailing kids, they look at these boats, they look at what goes on out there, the athletic side, that risk and the fun factor, and they say, hey, I want to try that. I want to do that. And that's a great thing, you know, for our sport.
Let me ask both Norbert and Julian, since both of you had such a strong investment in this, emotionally, personally, can you talk about what it felt like when the 34th Cup was won and it was over? I mean, or that moment, really, when you knew the finish line had been crossed. Julian?
I was just incredulous, and during the last race, I just couldn't even speak. Actually watching many of the final races, it was completely absorbing and became an obsession, and I was unable to actually report because I was so wrapped up in the outcome, in every minute. And then also just in the sense of how fast they were going, how dangerous what they were doing was, and how, you know, just how risky it was, how something calamitous was just possibly a second away. So it was a very unnerving process. And then it was just this sense of, again, how did they do that? And so then I started my reporting again. You know, it was really just, wow, I'm just wowed by this. I want to know about the technology. I want to know about the sailing. I want to know, you know, was Jimmy training before he went onto the boat? Was he, you know, what were they eating? How did they do this?
So that you were also taken by the aesthetics, though, too, weren't you? The beauty of it.
Oh, I don't know how you cannot be, you know. And then just the choreography that goes on out on the water with these guys is a beautiful thing to watch. And you would see these, you know, these foiling catamarans, and it was just glorious. Still, when I look out at the bay, I can still see the boats out there racing. It was such a beautiful, indelible image.
Can you recreate that feeling for us, Commodore? I mean, when they went over the finish line?
After I picked my heart up off the floor?
Yeah,
I mean, we had 19 races, and the last eight, I mean, we were match point each time. We're not match point. It was one step at a time. But you asked an earlier question about the concession letter, and the one thing that I had to do when I had to leave my yacht club, which were, I was happy to be with my members and viewing the races, and I had to get camped down there at Pier 29, Pier 27, for the fact that if we did lose, I had to be there to present the trophy to Steve Burrow, the New Zealand Commodore. When we won that last race, and I knew I didn't have to do that, hell, it was great. And all I could say is, we're going to do it again. It is good.
Okay, that brings us to the last question, and it's one that I've kind of had in my mind for a while now, and that is, was it better the second time around? I mean, the first time was history in itself, and this was, as so many have said, it's almost become a platitude, you know, the greatest comeback in history. So the feelings were different. I mean, first was sort of virginal, I suppose, and the second was a repeat, but it was so extraordinary. Can you address that?
Yeah, no question. The second time was the better one. You know, I mean, as for the third one, it'd be nice to not have to go through the way we did it the second time. But but no, look, I think for any athlete, the thing that really interests you is what are you going to do when things aren't going well, you know, especially in a team environment, because when you're winning, well, everyone gets along, you know, and it's good times, and, you know, you see it in everyday life when times are good. But when you're facing some tough moments in your life, or in our case, we were facing we had a real hill to climb, well, then you see the team, you know, then you see the players that you want around you, and that, you know, that's why I think that second time was, I mean, you couldn't have written that sort of a script. It's one of those teams that, you know, for all the guys, no matter really what happens now for a lot of those guys, they'll remember that for the rest of their lives, and they'll have that connection with each other that they've gone through, and they'll have the connection with the guys, their competitors that they went against, because their competitors know what they went through, and they're really the only ones that have that sort of an understanding at that level, you know, of the pressure. And, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. Funny enough, even the time it's spent since we pulled it off, I really think for a lot of us, you're still kind of learning about it in yourself. You're thinking back to moments, and it's something that may take longer to really, truly understand and appreciate what went on. But it was one hell of an experience. I mean, it's such a... you really have created, I guess, in that sort of a team atmosphere when you go through something like that, you know, you sort of almost go to hell and back, then you, it's like a family. And so you'll, no matter what happens, whether you split apart, and you'll always have that connection just like you do with a family member.
Well, hearty congratulations again to you and this extraordinary team for your achievement. Remarkable.
Thank you.
Our thanks again to two-time America's Cup winner, Oracle Team USA skipper Jimmy Spithill, Commodore of San Francisco's Golden Gate Yacht Club, Norbert Byron, and San Francisco Chronicle journalist Julian Guthrie, author of The Billionaire and the Mechanic, how Larry Ellison and a car mechanic teamed up to win sailing's greatest race, the America's Cup twice. We also want to thank you, our audience who are here, and the audience we have on radio, television, and the Internet. I am Michael Krasny, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.